And where are we going?
Welcome, friends. This is Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. We are recording this from Sweden. My name is Henrik Palmgren. I'm the editor and webmaster of redicecreations.com. If you are new to this program and or this website, let me just mention that Red Ice Creations Radio is available with a new show every Thursday and Sunday online through our website. We have an archive going back to about a year, all free material there. And we do also have a subscriber section with subscriber interviews with our guests for all you guys who want to go a little bit deeper into some of these subjects and hear even more. So check a look at that if you are interested. All right, I'm very glad that you are here today. I'm really excited about today's program. We have the great pleasure of welcoming Ralph Ellis to the show. He is an author, historian, and researcher, and he's behind a number of titles. Jesus, Last of the Pharaohs, Thoth, Architect of the Universe, Eden in Egypt, to name a few. And his latest two books are called Cleopatra to Christ and Skota, Egyptian Queen of the Scots. Ralph's website is edfu-books.com. That's edfu-books.com. And the series of books that Ralph puts out is about theological and historical re-evaluation. And Ralph's name and research and reference have come up a number of times on this program through other guests. So it's great to have Ralph with us today to be able to talk with him about his work and books, of course. So with that, let's say hello to Ralph and welcome. Thank you for coming on the show. It's a pleasure to have you here, Ralph.
Yes, indeed. Very very good to be on the show, indeed. It's nice to get exposure in the rest of Europe as well. I've been concentrating mostly on Britain and America, of course. Mm-hmm. But Europe is, you know, there's a big market and a big interest.
Ah, excellent. Yeah, it's great to have you. And as I said, Ralph, your name and reference have come up a number of times on this show through our good friend Michael Tsarion, Jay Kutsi, etc. And so it's great to have you here. And I kind of want to begin today, if we can, to talk a little bit about you for people who aren't, you know, familiar with you and your work. It's always interesting to hear how people get started with their research, and you have released a series of titles that kind of follows this red line, I think. And how did you first stumble upon these topics and your research that you're doing now?
Well, I suppose I started originally with my father when I was very young, because he was interested in theology. Not to the degree that I am, but as youngsters, we used to go around all of the cathedrals of Europe, and we had a big interest in it. But I suppose the interest really started with, I suppose, the sort of von Daniken era, when suddenly von Daniken came up with the idea that there was an alternative history possibly out there, and that sort of fascinated me. So I linked that alternative history in with the fact that we don't know a great deal about our biblical history, because, you know, I started studying the Bible having gone around all the major cathedrals with my father, and I couldn't believe that we had this history that nobody seems to know much about. It seemed to me that the biblical story almost happened on a different planet, because none of it links in with standard history. And I just could not believe that that was true. How could that be so? You know, we've got this historical book that has come down to us through the millennia, and none of it matches in with normal history. And so there's only two options, and a lot of archaeologists have gone down the second option, and the second option is that it's all mythology, that someone made it all up, that it's just a story. But I didn't really believe that was true either, because there's too much history and baggage attached to it for someone to have just made this story up completely. And so the other option is that it's a true history, but maybe a little distorted, and therefore it's because of this distortion that we cannot find the characters in the Bible. That's the theory that I ran with, and it became very obvious very early on that that was the true history, that things have been distorted and we've forgotten our history.
very interesting. It, you know, seems to be quite a daunting task, I guess, to take on the historical and, I guess, even archaeological.
Yeah, it's been done before, and this is why I think it's not exactly a cover-up or a conspiracy, but this has been done before many centuries ago, many millennia ago. People knew more about this history than we seem to know now. I mean, if you read Josephus, for instance, Josephus Flavius, the first century AD historian, he clearly says that the early Israelites were the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt. Now, that's what I had started on when I first started this investigation. And here, Josephus Flavius is agreeing with me entirely. Well, he obviously came before I did. So even in that era, people knew that there was a different alternative history, perhaps, to the one that's currently understood today. So I think knowledge has been lost, and it's about time that that we regained it.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, how long have you been, as you said, you have obviously a huge, you know, your background in regards to your father and so forth into studying these areas, but when did you kind of first stumble upon the connection to Egypt? Because that seems to be a huge, you know, area in your research.
Yes, that probably happened about 15 years ago or so, when I was researching the Exodus, and I came across, of course, this alternative Exodus, which happens to be very, very similar to the biblical one. For instance, I'll just read out a few of the sort of topics. And this is from history, of course. This is nothing to do with the Bible. There were a people in Egypt, and they were known as shepherds. And one of their kings was called Jacob. And they wore earrings, and they had their hair in ringlets, and they were circumcised. And they were involved in a war with the southern Egyptians. But at the same time as this, there were storms and darkness and plagues. And as a result of this, there was a civil war, and some 500,000 of these people, these shepherds, were ejected from Egypt on a big exodus. And they set off from Pi Ramesses, and they went to Jerusalem. And they were quite a large military force, and they destroyed Jericho. Now, does that sound a wee bit familiar?
Yeah, it does.
But that's not biblical history. This is real history. This is the history of the Hyksos people of Egypt, were the Lower Egyptians, and they are thought to have been immigrants. We're not quite sure, but they took over Lower Egypt. That's the northern half of Egypt, and they set up their own kingship there. So Egypt was divided, as it often was during its history. So there was a southern pharaoh and there was a northern pharaoh, and these northern pharaohs were called the Hyksos, or the shepherd kings. And of course, all of the patriarchs within the Bible, of course, are called shepherds. But they seem to have the same name. So, you know, one of the pharaohs of this dynasty was called Jacob, Jacoba. And, of course, one of the patriarchs was called Jacob. So it just seemed to me hugely unlikely that there would be two exoduses that were so similar to each other during biblical history, during Egyptian history, that these two exodus events had to be the same event.
Yeah,
that just seemed to be a given truth.
So
they were too similar for any other logical deduction. But that one item changes the whole of the Bible, because it means that suddenly you've got to start equating a lot of the Old Testament texts with Egyptian history. And people don't want to do that, because that upsets a lot of our current understanding of biblical history.
Sure.
And so people shy away from that, whether they are theologians, whether they are Egyptologists. There are too many people out there with things to lose if they start going off on this tangent. You know, if they belong to a religious institution, it will go against their beliefs. If they belong to a if they belong to a university, they might even lose funding. Who knows?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
If they start going off on these different tracks. And so people shy away from it. But it's quite obvious to me that the most of the biblical history was based in Egypt. And if we start looking at the texts, we find that a lot of the texts in the Bible, a lot of what it's saying, actually comes out of Egyptian history.
Hmm.
And there are quite a few of these, whether it's, you know, Psalm 104 is the most famous of these. Psalm 104 comes from the hymn to the Aten.
Mm-hmm.
Which was written by the pharaoh Akhenaten.
Yeah.
But there are a number of these. I mean, the Joseph plot of Joseph going down into Egypt it essentially is the same as the tale of the two brothers, which is an Egyptian text.
Hmm.
The Nile turning red, which is a strange incident in the Bible that no one can really explain, well, that comes from the destruction of mankind, which is another Egyptian text.
Hmm.
The Lord's Prayer comes from the Maxims of Annie. The Sermon on the Mount, which is, you know, the famous part of the New Testament, also
sure.
comes from the Maxims of Annie.
Huh.
You know, especially the bit of, about where Jesus says, you know, God does not like it if you indulge in vain repetitions.
Mm-hmm.
That comes straight from the Maxims of Annie.
Hmm.
Proverbs, there's a great section of Proverbs comes out of the instructions of Amenemopet, and it's almost word for word.
Hmm.
And so it goes on. So it's quite clear, and if this is not generally known in the public, but if you read the theological texts and so on, it is actually quite well known within people who look at the text,
yeah.
These are direct comparisons between these two.
Hmm.
So people know that there are direct comparisons, but they're not really making it known to the general public.
Hmm.
So, but the bottom line is that much of the teachings, not only of the Old Testament, but of the New Testament as well, the teachings of Jesus, actually come straight out of Egyptian history.
Hmm.
And so there is a direct link there between Judaic history and Egyptian history, which is basically what I'm saying has happened all the way through.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems like a religious authority should be kind of excited about this, because it's, in a historical sense, then it would actually verify the Bible. But as you say, this information isn't, I guess, received that well. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's dangerous. Yes, I would see it in the same way that you see it, that it actually makes the whole of the Bible more believable, because you can actually find it, you can find real information in there, real people, real text.
Yeah.
It, to me, it makes it more authoritative if it's based in real history.
Sure.
But there are lots of problems for theologians, because it changes the theology that they are trying to teach. It means that the teachings of Jesus were not unique, and that has a big bearing on what they're trying to teach.
Yeah,
it means that Jesus was just regurgitating old teaching.
Mm, yeah,
he was not a unique character. He was just one of a long line of characters who were teaching these same truisms, these same teachings.
Hmm.
They've turned Jesus into such a unique God figure that to have him just as one in a great line of princes, because I believe he was a prince of Egypt, of course, takes that uniqueness away from him. And of course, they will not entertain that. And the Jews have the same problem, because the Jews say that they are a unique people, you know, etc.
Mm.
And they were persecuted by the Egyptians, and what I'm saying is that they were Egyptians themselves.
Yeah.
So the Jews have a problem as well with putting the Old Testament back into Egypt.
Mm.
It means they were not necessarily the persecuted underdogs, you know, with the terrible pharaoh chasing them out of their country.
Mm.
They were actually as powerful as the pharaoh himself, because there were two pharaohs. There was a pharaoh in the south, and there was a pharaoh in the north. And the northern pharaoh was a Jew. He was a Jewish pharaoh.
Hmm.
Because the Jews were the Hyksos, the northern Egyptians.
Yeah.
So you can imagine from a theological perspective, that causes quite a few problems.
Yeah.
And there are more problems to come, which we will probably come across as we continue this interview.
Yeah.
There are plenty of problems that this actually provides. One of those, I suppose we might as well go on to it.
Sure, sure.
That these people were Egyptians. They were in Egypt. And they had a sacred mountain. So where would that sacred mountain be if these people were Egyptians? Because there's this very strange thing in the Bible. Because you have these people that even, as the Bible admits, were in Egypt.
Mm.
Whose leaders were very powerful. Joseph was prime minister of all Egypt, of course.
Hmm.
Moses was a prince of Egypt. And according to Josephus and his history, Moses was an army commander. He was the top army commander in Egypt who led the expedition against the Nubians in the south.
Hmm.
So these were powerful people who lived in northern Egypt next to Heliopolis. In the north by Cairo.
Mm.
And Joseph, with his coat of many colors, of course, was obviously a priest because he married the high priest of Heliopolis's daughter.
Yeah.
Now, if you're marrying into the high priesthood, well, you've got to be a part of that association, really.
Mm.
It's pretty obvious that Joseph was also a high priest as well. So he was prime minister and high priest of Egypt.
Mm. You know,
That means that he must have been substantially Egyptian. You could not become high priest of Egypt if you did not fully follow all of the Egyptian religion, if you were not fully conversant with Egyptian language, etc., and culture.
Mm.
He must have been entirely Egyptian.
Mm.
But there is a problem with the Bible, because these people were living in Heliopolis. And yet nowhere in the whole of the Bible do they mention the pyramids of Giza.
Hmm.
Now, these were the most marvelous, magnificent monuments in the whole of the world.
Yeah.
You know, in an era when most people lived in mud huts, here was a monument that reached 155 meters into the sky.
Hmm.
Now, this was an absolutely awe-inspiring monument, and yet not once in the whole of the Bible does it mention the pyramids of Giza.
Hmm.
Which is very strange, isn't it?
It is, yeah, certainly.
How can you have this great text of Egypt and not mention the pyramids? Well, they do mention the pyramids, but it's just that we've got the names slightly confused. In the Bible, the Great Pyramid of Giza is actually called Mount Sinai.
Hmm.
Because if you're going to have a sacred mountain in Egypt, and if you're going to have a sacred mountain of not simply the Jews, but the Hyksos, who were, you know, the lower Egyptians,
mm-hmm.
where is that sacred mountain going to be? Is it going to be some rocky crag in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula somewhere, miles away from where they lived,
mm-hmm.
and just a rocky outcrop? Is that going to be sacred? Or are you going to have a mountain, a man-made mountain, that reaches up into the sky 150 meters, that is absolutely made millimeter perfect all the way up to its very, very surface?
Yeah.
A mountain that contains mathematical knowledge. Because we all know, of course, that the pyramids are built on mathematical principles. I presume people are aware of that.
Yes, we've been discussing that on this show, so absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone will know that the pyramids contain mathematical knowledge. These were the sacred mountains. And we can sort of vaguely sort of prove that by looking at the descriptions it gives within the Bible. And using the Bible, the Quran, because the Quran mentions them as well, and Josephus, we get the following descriptions of Mount Sinai. It's supposed to be sharp. Yes, it is.
Mm.
Difficult to climb, certainly. It's sharply delineated from the surrounding plain. You were able to cordon it off. They put a cordon around the bottom of the mountain, so you couldn't touch it because you were not allowed to touch the mountain. Now, how do you do that with a normal mountain? Rather difficult.
Yeah.
But you can do it with a pyramid quite easily. You can put a cordon around the bottom, a fence around the bottom.
Sure.
To stop people touching it. It's so it must have been quite a small mountain, really, if you could cordon it off. And yet it says it was the highest mountain in the land. Well, of course, the highest mountain in Egypt is the Great Pyramid.
Yeah.
It's said to be on the edge of a desert. Yes, it certainly was. And it had a passageway that went inside the mountain, because the Bible is quite specific here, and there are some mistranslations in the different Bibles, because I don't know if you know, every Bible is different. And I take information from 16 Bibles, and they're all slightly different to each other.
Sure, yeah.
Of those Bibles, five say that Moses went to the top of Mount Sinai, and the other 11 say that Moses went into the mountain. So there must be a cave inside the mountain.
Yeah.
And of course, there is a cave inside the Great Pyramid. And these caves at the bottom of the Great Pyramid were always open. They were not shut off, because Strabo specifically mentions that there was a door that could be opened and you could go down to the bottom. So Strabo, you know, just slightly BC, knew that there was an open entrance to the pyramid, that you could go down to the cave at the bottom.
Finally,
it says in the Bible that Mount Sinai was surrounded by a black basalt pavement. It says there was a pavement that looks like the night sky. So where are you going to find, in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula, a mountain with a black basalt pavement around the outside that was so shiny and smooth that you had to take your shoes off before going onto it? Well, you're not going to find it in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula. But if you look at the Great Pyramid, of course, on the eastern side of the Great Pyramid, where the causeways go out, you will see the remains of the black basalt pavement once stood outside on the eastern side of the Great Pyramid. And it was quite obvious that in its heyday, it was beautifully polished and absolutely smooth. And I have no doubt that the priesthood would have had to have taken their shoes off before stepping upon it. So it's quite obvious to me that, again, we have a fusion here between the Old Testament text and the history of Egypt. And Mount Sinai was most definitely the Great Pyramid of Giza.
Must have been an amazing sight with a white limestone on those pyramids, and as you say, a black a bottom floor plan, basically. Must have been an incredible sight.
Absolutely. But here, of course, we have the standard Egyptian dualism. You know, Egyptian religion was all about dualism. And we have, of course, black and white. We have the white of the pyramid and the black of the pavement.
Indeed.
Perfect Egyptian dualism.
You know, I did want to kind of get into that. I don't know if you want to do this right away, but I did wanted to ask you, you know, regarding the connection, I guess, between, the symbolism within masonry itself and of course, address the checkerboard and material like this. I don't know if you want to go there yet, or
yeah,
wanna...
why not? It is very Masonic, of course.
Sure.
One of the offshoots of Egyptian theology, which has preserved, in some senses, the theology in a more precise fashion than Christianity or Judaism has, is masonry. And of course, within a Masonic lodge, you will have a black and white checkerboard floor. And I'm sure this has come in some way from this pavement that was at the bottom of the Great Pyramid. Because there are a number of chips of top quality marble were found there as well. So I'm pretty sure that this black basalt pavement had a checkerboard edge to it or something of that nature.
Hmm.
So I'm sure this checkerboard image has come straight out of Egypt.
Hmm.
And of course, every Masonic temple is formed of a double square. That is the perfect Masonic temple.
Hmm.
And of course, if you look at the King's Chamber inside the Great Pyramid, of course, it is a double square.
Hmm.
It's twice as long as it is wide.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also faces east-west, which is exactly the same as a Masonic temple has to face.
Hmm.
So the long edge of the temple is always east-west.
Hmm.
So a Masonic temple, the layout has been formed from the image of the King's Chamber inside the Great Pyramid. I'm certain of that.
You know, regarding the three lights within the Masonic Lodge, would you say that these, in some sense, could represent then the three big pyramids?
It's quite possible because they might be an image of the sun because the Giza layout was designed for tracking the sun,
mm-hmm.
the movements of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that is what Masonic ritual is all about as well.
Sure.
The sun starts on the east, it goes round to the junior warden at the south, and then round to the senior warden on the west. So it's following the same circuit of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Could they be images of the pyramids? Possibly, because if you look at the tracing board of the first degree, you will see that the imagery of the first degree tracing board is exactly the same as the layout of Giza.
Hmm.
So for listeners who are not familiar with that tracing board, there are three pillars on the tracing board, with one very tall pillar, one slightly shorter and one much shorter, just as we see on the three pyramids at Giza.
Hmm.
And then we have, you know, the checkerboard floor is there. We have the a plug of stone, which is no doubt something to do with the entrance. And then we have Jacob's ladder going up, which I'm sure was a part of the Great Pyramid before the casing stones were taken off. I'm sure there was a flight of steps used to go to the top.
Hmm.
And, of course, the pillars are... they are associated with the sun and the moon.
Mm.
And for a long time, I've already written that the Great Pyramid was associated with the sun.
Mm, yeah.
And the second pyramid was associated with the moon. So, yes, the symbolism there between the tracing board and Giza is almost perfect.
Ah, fascinating. You know, do you think that it's possible to connect... you know, the image of the all-seeing eye or the eye above the pyramid, because I was considering the fact that what you were talking about earlier, you know, in regards to Moses and so forth, going either into or, you know, at the top of Mount Sinai, or in this case, then the pyramid itself. But isn't there a connection between also a volcano and an active volcano in the symbolism or the language of Moses and when he went up to the mountain, because the imagery, I guess, could be, I see that there is a connection between an active volcano in regards to being a light on top of the pyramid or on top of the mountain. Then. Do you would agree on that?
Yes, because everything in Egyptian theology was not only dualist, but could be read in two ways, in two fashions. So it became very convoluted, very complicated.
Mm.
And I think you can look at this symbolism in two fashions. I think the original symbolism was that the all-seeing eye was probably associated with the third pyramid. And I don't know if you know that, but all of the pyramidions, they're the little capstones that go on the top of the pyramid.
Mm, sure.
They all had the two eyes of Ra on them, inscribed on them.
Hmm.
So the very top of the pyramid would have the Eye of Ra.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So exactly as you see on the back of the $1 note.
Sure, sure.
And exactly as you see on the first degree tracing board. But on the top of the Great Pyramid, I'm pretty sure that this had a platform on the top. It was the unfinished pyramid.
Mm.
And for a reason, because Egyptian theology is all about astronomy, or astrology, if you'd like to call it in that fashion, but it was as much astronomy as it was astrology.
Mm.
And so you would need a viewing platform if you were going to do any serious astrology. And the Great Pyramid, of course, would provide the best platform possible in Egypt for viewing the heavens.
Mm.
It would be above the smog of all the little fires brewing their cups of tea down below.
Mm.
And it would have the first sight, of course, of Ra as he came over the horizon, long before anyone on the ground would see Ra.
Mm.
So it would be an ideal viewing platform. So I'm pretty sure that the priesthood would have gone to the top of the Great Pyramid. And they would probably, as a part of their ritual, because we know this ritual came down through Judaic tradition,
mm.
they may well have made sacrifices on the top of there as well. A little bit like the Central American people made sacrifices on the top of their pyramid.
Mm, sure.
And so you would then have an image of a large pyramid with smoke coming out of the top of it.
Hmm.
Because they would be making sacrifices, and of course as soon as you're making a sacrifice onto a fire, of course you'll get loads of smoke, etc.
Sure.
So you'd have a very volcano-like image. From the Giza pyramids anyway.
Mm. Mm.
However, on top of that, the whole of this Exodus business occurred, the whole of this plagues and storms and all the rest of it occurred because the island of Thera exploded in about 1620 BC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here we have another, as it were, pyramid with fire on the top. Here we had a real volcano.
Yeah.
I don't know how big that volcano was, but they used to call the island Kiftu, didn't they, which was the island with a pillar.
Hmm.
That's what it meant, the island with a pillar.
Yeah.
And the pillar would have been, you know, the steady stream of smoke, obviously, that was billowing out of the top of this volcano.
Mm.
Well, that volcano erupted in about 1620 BC, and it covered the whole of the Eastern Med with a huge great ash cloud. And we know that ash fell in Egypt because they found the layer of ash in northern Egypt. So we know that the ash got as far as Egypt.
Hmm.
And here again, of course, we bring back the links with the Old Testament because Moses says exactly the same. And I'm just trying to find the exact wording that
sure.
he used, because here it is. Exodus 9:8, if anyone's got their Bibles handy. And the Lord said unto Moses and unto Aaron, take you handfuls of ashes of the furnace, and let Moses sprinkle it towards the heaven in the sight of Pharaoh, and it shall become small dust in all of the land of Egypt. Now, what's that, if that is not the ashfall coming out of Thera?
Yeah.
That is an absolute perfect description of the ashfall from Thera.
Hmm.
And it is that event that caused the plagues, and it is that event that caused the Exodus. So here we have the cause of the Exodus.
Huh.
Was actually a very similar incident, imagery, rather,
mm-hmm.
the Giza pyramids itself. There must have been sailors out there who were near Santorini. In fact, we know there were sailors, because if you read the Epic of Jason and the Argonauts,
mm-hmm.
it is a perfect description of the eruption of Thera.
Ah.
And of course, Jason landed on the island next door to Thera.
Yeah.
So we know where he was. He was next door to Thera.
Hmm.
And he's describing this great beast that hurls rocks at them, you know, and they were covered in darkness during the day. For two whole days, they were covered in darkness with this great monster throwing rocks at them. Well, what's that if that was not the eruption of Thera?
Sure.
So you would have had sailors around that era who would have seen this pillar, this great volcano with this great eruption of fire on its summit.
Mm.
which the priesthood of Egypt would have recognized instantly as being the same imagery as their Mount Sinai, the same as the Great Pyramid, with the sacrifices being made on the summit. And so we have this sort of dualism here between the God being angry at Thera by using the same imagery as the priesthood were using at Egypt. Funny that, isn't it? And it was that incident, of course, that started the civil war between the Hyksos and the southern Egyptians. And we know that because the Hyksos were pushed out of Egypt only about 50 years after the eruption of Thera. So it's pretty obvious that the two were coincident. They were coincident in chronology. They were coincident in the fact that in the War of the Egyptians, which is another ancient Egyptian text, it says that the Hyksos were evicted from Egypt after a great storm came over Egypt, which is what it says on the Tempest Stella as well. And the Tempest Stella is rather interesting because it appears to have quotations from the Old Testament on it. Now, the Tempest Stella was written by Ahmose the First, who was the pharaoh from southern Egypt who actually kicked the Hyksos out of Egypt. So we have this exact timing. We have Ahmose the First, who lived around sort of 1570 BC. We have the Thera eruption, which was about 1620 BC. And we know that Ahmose kicked the Hyksos out of Egypt. And we know that at the same time, he commissioned a stella that said that there were storms, a very unusual storm that hit Egypt and covered it in darkness for 3 days. And that was, of course, the plagues incident, exactly the same as Moses was talking about. So we have this perfect confluence of text and history. And so effectively, the whole of the Bible was only written, really, because of the Thera eruption. Because these people were driven out of Egypt and they lost their homes. And so they wrote down a history of their people. And that became the Old Testament.
Fascinating. You know, would you say that, you know, the Western world, or I guess in some sense the modern world, then is a kind of spawn from Egypt, or that even our culture and architecture is an offshoot from this, you know, Hyksos culture, I guess, then?
Yes, very definitely, because in some sense it was their downfall, but in some senses it was also the downfall that made them. And it even says that in the protocols of the Elders of Zion, although I'm not entirely sure it was talking about the Moses Exodus. I think it was actually talking about the sort of first century Jesus Exodus after the destruction of Jerusalem. But it says exactly the same thing, that we thought the Exodus was our downfall, but in fact it was the making of us. Because Egypt was the superpower of that region in 1500, 1550 BC. It was the superpower. And yet, a great proportion, and the texts say anything up to a million people, but obviously there is a tendency for exaggeration sometimes in these texts, were kicked out of Egypt. And they could have gone anywhere. And I think they did go anywhere, because I write, you know, quite a lot about, you know, the exodus of Queen Scota and people of that nature, which I'm sure we will come on to later. So these people were pushed out of Egypt, and they could have gone by land up towards Syria and even across to Babylon. But they may have gone out across the Mediterranean on boats as well, because we know that the early Egyptians were great boat makers, and their boats could easily sail across the Mediterranean. And we also know that these very people the very same people, the Hyksos people of Lower Egypt, were great friends with the Minoans.
Hmm.
And of course, it was the Minoans who had been pushed out of Thera originally, and a lot of them had settled in northern Egypt with the Hyksos. That's why that they were there, because they were pushed out of their homeland by the Thera eruption. But of course, the Minoans were the great sailors of that era.
Mm.
So now we have a people being pushed out of Egypt, and they have a complete navy to do it with. So we don't necessarily need an exodus across the Sinai Peninsula going up to Jerusalem. We can have an exodus that goes across the Mediterranean to any of the islands and any of the places in the Western Mediterranean. So these people who went out across the Mediterranean were the superpower of that era, and they find themselves in places like Sicily and Corsica and Malta, where and the Balearic Islands in next to Spain. And they find themselves with almost uninhabited lands and with a people that were culturally and technologically far below them. So they were able, obviously, to take over these lands, to take over these peoples, to show them that the technology that they understood in terms of metallurgy, whatever it happens to be, you know, weapon manufacture, whatever it was. And they could turn these people from being backward cultures into major rival civilizations. And this is why we suddenly see the sudden rise of Greece, of the Western Mediterranean, of the Spanish mainland, of the Balearic Islands. They all began to blossom in about this era. And this is why I think they did, because they were given this infusion of technology and knowledge from these people who had been evicted from Egypt. So they seeded new cultures and new civilizations all across the Mediterranean because of this one very event.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That's, you know, again, I think it's fascinating that it also validates the, you know, in that sense, the Bible historically. But I mean, do you think that in regards to the Bible, that it has been edited and so forth, or are you looking into other texts, you know, apocryphal texts and so forth?
I look at all of them. I mean, the information is all there, but yes, it has been corrupted. So you have to be very careful about what it says. And if you read it correctly, you will find that the information is 100% correct and 100% original, as it was, almost verbatim. You just need to have to understand what it's talking about. And one of the classic ones is of Joseph going down into Egypt. Joseph goes into Egypt and he becomes prime minister, as I said before. And then his family come down. And he's a bit worried about this, and he says to his brothers as they come down, because he had 11 brothers, as you know, and he said to his brothers, look, Pharaoh is going to want to speak to you, but whatever you do, when you see Pharaoh, don't say that we are shepherds. You must say instead that we are that we look after cattle, we're cattle herders. Because if Pharaoh finds out that we were shepherds, he will throw you out of the land of Egypt, because shepherds are an abomination to the Egyptians. And you've got to think, hold on, what does this mean? Why is he saying this? And the answer is, excuse me.
No problem.
The answer is that we're not translating this properly. In the Bible, it is given as a warning about agriculture, about real shepherds, about real cattle breeders. But it wasn't. It was all to do with astrology. And what he was really meaning is that when you meet Pharaoh, do not tell him that we are shepherd kings, i.e. the Hyksos, but tell Pharaoh instead that we are bull worshippers, not cattle breeders, but bull worshippers. Because remember, the great religion of Egypt, of course, was the Apis bull. Because shepherds are an abomination to the Egyptians, and they will throw us out of the country. Well, yes, of course they would have done, because Joseph was a descendant of the Hyksos, who were known as the shepherds. They were the shepherd pharaohs. And so, of course, the Egyptians would have hated the Hyksos, because they just had a civil war with them. And they'd just thrown them out of the country in a great exodus. So no wonder that they would have been hated by the southern Egyptians. So effectively, it makes sense if you view it in terms of theology and not in terms of agriculture.
Yeah.
So what we might have here in the Bible is an actual verbatim conversation between Joseph and his brothers regarding the pharaoh, the southern pharaoh, who would have been Ahmose the first, or probably Thutmose of the first, about that era anyway, about 1500 odd BC. So it's quite possible that the Bible is not only correct, but also verbatim correct, with actual conversations between actual people, because it actually makes sense if we understand the context. And the context is not farmers and looking after sheep and a few bulls. It's about the theology of Egypt between the Apis bull worshippers and the shepherd kings. And of course, this difference between the Apis bull worshippers and the shepherd kings is all astrology, of course. I presume your listeners know all about precession, yes?
Sure, we have talked about that too, yeah.
Okay, so that they're quite familiar with that. Well, the era of Taurus ended in about 1800 BC, of course. And that would have been the era of the Apis bull worship. And after Taurus, the next constellation, of course, was Aries. And so in about 1700, 1800 BC, there was this change between Taurus and Aries. And I've no doubt that this is why the shepherd kings became known as the shepherd kings, because they went with the new constellation. And the southern Egyptians did not, for whatever reason. They were no longer looking at the heavens. They didn't realize that the heavens had changed. And so they kept on with their old Apis bull worship. Whereas the southern Egyptians, the northern Egyptians had changed and gone on to Aries, and that's why they were called the shepherd kings, the Hyksos, Hykel Kasuts.
So this is another story, I guess, of a people who have, you know, adopted, I guess, the new age, so to speak, and now they are at war with the previous age.
They're saying to the people in southern Egypt, you know, why haven't you changed?
Sure.
Why are you not following the constellations?
Yeah.
Well, you should be supporting Aries now. And they weren't. So this is another source of contention between the north and the south.
And this is mirrored, I guess, in the story of Moses, after he comes down from the mountain and sees his people worshipping the bull again.
Of course, they were worshipping the bull again. So he had Apis bull worshippers amongst his congregation. So what does he do when he sees them? He kills 3,000 of his followers for following the Apis bull. So again, yes, we can see this this battle between the Apis bull worshippers and the shepherds.
Yeah.
Of course, the patriarchs were known as shepherds.
Hmm.
So, and this is what it was all about. It was a conflict between the constellations. And of course, into this conflict between the constellations, there came this almighty great explosion of the island of Thera. Now, of course, that meant the gods were angry. So why were the gods angry? Well, it's because, you know, these Apis bull worshippers hadn't changed, had they? You know, they're still doing the old things. And so we have an extra layer of contention between these people. You know, not only are they worshipping the wrong constellation, but now the gods are angry and they've caused this darkness for 3 days across the lands of Egypt. So, you know, it was ripe for conflict.
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah. You know, there is a story in the Bible that, you know, Moses actually were aware of what was going to happen in regards to, I guess, the eruption, you know, that we're talking about. Do you think that that is accurate or, you know, constructions made afterwards, so to speak?
No, he might have known what was going to happen. It depends on their knowledge of volcanology. But we do know from the evidence in Thera that the mountain did give warnings before it finally erupted. So it gave a number of earthquakes before the main eruption. And we know this because the island was actually evacuated before the eruption took place. And there was an earthquake because they had these steps that were broken before the ash fall covered them. So we know that the island was giving plenty of warning that it was going to do something nasty.
Huh.
And that is why, of course, the Minoans turned up in Lower Egypt. And that's why we have a Minoan palace stuck right next to the Hyksos in Avaris. They actually found a Minoan palace there. Why were they there? Well, and this is why I can't understand archaeologists sometimes. You know, we have these very eminent archaeologists who uncover this, and this was uncovered by Bitak, who was a very famous German, I think he is. Yes, he's German, archaeologist. And he's wondering in his journals, why do we have Minoans, you know, in Avaris, in 1600 BC or whatever it was? Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? You know, Thera was just about to erupt, or it had just erupted, and we know the population of Thera was not killed by the eruption, because there is no evidence of any people there, just the houses. So where did they go to? Well, there are only two places they would have gone to. They're two main trading partners. One was Crete, just down the road, the real Minoans, as it were, and the other major trading partner they had was Egypt. And we know that because there were lots of common artifacts between the two lands. So where would they have gone to? Well, it's quite obvious. They went to Avaris, quite a lot of them, and there they built this new palace. And that's why we have this Minoan palace stuck in the middle of Avaris. Which is interesting again, but for another era. I mean, we're talking about the Exodus here, but following this event, many years later, three centuries later, we had a new pharaoh of Egypt, who again came from the north. He was basically from Avaris. And he was a pharaoh who had very strange tastes. And he liked free-flowing artistry and really realistic scenes and all sorts of, for Egypt, quite revolutionary art. And you probably know who I'm talking about.
Akhenaten, right?
Akhenaten.
Yeah.
So where did he get his love of free-flowing art from? Well, if you look at the artistry of Amarna and compare it with the Minoans, you'll find out exactly where he got his artistry from. And of course, he was a pharaoh who was brought up in northern Egypt. He would have had many Minoan compatriots, and we know from Amarna that there was quite a lot of trade with the Minoans still, even in the Amarna era. And this is where his revolutionary style comes from. Like everything, it's not revolutionary as such, it's just been borrowed. So he obviously preferred Minoan architecture, and he borrowed it, and he used it in Amarna, and that's why we see this flourishing of this new style within Egypt.
Fascinating. You know, Ralph, we are coming up to the end of this first segment here. But before we kind of finish things off and continue in the second part for our subscribers, I But, you know, this is a fascinating story, and there's so much more to talk about here, obviously. But I wanted to give you a chance to you know, tell people about your website, and also, of course, mention your books and some of the titles you got out there, and I guess what you would recommend for people who want to dive into this from the beginning, so to speak, and say how people can get your books, of course, also.
Okay, well, the website is www.edfu-books.com, and Edfu is spelt E-D-F-U, so that's edfu-books.com. And really, for people embarking on this, probably the best one to start on is the first book I wrote, which is Jesus, Last of the Pharaohs.
Mm.
And that is a brief rush through all of this history, all the way from the Exodus, all the way through to the era of Jesus. And that gives you a sort of background to most of this. The best of my series is, funnily enough, one that doesn't sell the most. And I'm still perplexed by this. I think it's either too complex for people, or perhaps they can't believe that I've actually discovered what I've discovered. And that book is Solomon, Falcon of Sheba, which I'm shortly going to rename as Solomon, Pharaoh of Egypt, because I've actually found the tombs and the sarcophagi of King David, King Solomon, the Queen of Sheba, and Hiram Abiff, the hero of Masonic law.
Sure, sure, yeah.
So that is a very, very in-depth study, and it's got, considering the claims I'm making, it has got so much evidence that I have actually discovered the true tombs and sarcophagi of these people.
Hmm.
So it's an amazing story, that one.
Fascinating.
And that is my best recommendation. So that is Solomon, Falcon of Sheba.
Mm.
I then go through Eden in Egypt, which says that Adam and Eve were Akhenaten and Nefertiti.
Hmm.
That's an interesting story in itself.
Sure.
I have Tempest and Exodus, which covers the period of the Exodus, obviously, and the Tempest Stella of Amosi the First, which has biblical quotes on it. And a lot of people like my last one, and this is a strange double book. It's a back-to-back. You turn it around one way, and it's one book. You turn it around the other way, and it's another book.
Mm.
And it's the first of those books is Cleopatra to Christ.
Mm.
And that's interesting because it shows the true ancestry of Jesus, that he was a prince of Egypt, and his great-grandmother was actually Cleopatra the Seventh, the queen of Egypt.
Mm.
So that's a very interesting story in itself, and it's amazing how much evidence there is for that as well.
Mm.
And on the back of that book, we have Skota, Egyptian Queen of the Scots. Now, this is a slightly different era. This is going back to the era of Akhenaten again. And a Scottish story that's well over 1,000 years old, and probably as much as 1,500 years old at least, based on Irish and Scottish texts that go back that far, which say that the Irish and Scottish people were first settled by an Egyptian queen called Skota and her husband called Gaethelos. And it's from Skota and Gaethelos that the Scottish and Gaelic people were first named.
Mm.
So that's an interesting story, and most people take that as mythology, but again, looking at it, I thought, well, you know, there's got to be more to it than this.
Mm.
And so in looking at this story, I found quite a number of connections that indicate that this is a true history and not just mythology.
Fascinating.
So that's all the historical books I've got. Is there time to just mention two more?
Sure, absolutely. Do that before we...
yeah, sure. There is another couple.
Sure.
Not in the same series. These two are sort of separate. And they look at the pyramids of Egypt from a more of a mathematical viewpoint, and the henges of Britain, so Stonehenge and Avebury and places like that. And the first of those is called Thoth, Architect of the Universe. And that's interesting because it shows that we still have some inheritance from that era. And a classic inheritance that we do have is that the base of the Great Pyramid measures 1,760 cubits. And the old mile that we used to use in Britain, and they still use in America, of course, the mile, is 1,760 yards.
Mm.
We're still using the same units as they used for building the Great Pyramid. And following on from that book, because that book leaves you hanging, and you need a sequel to it, and the sequel is called K2, Quest of the Gods. And that takes us way up into the high Himalaya, where I found another pyramid sitting in the Himalaya. That's another story.
Yeah, very interesting stuff, absolutely. Are your books all available through your website?
Yes, they're all available on the website. That's edfu-books.com. And they're also available on Amazon, of course, if you want to go onto Amazon. And for anyone listening in who might be from America, if you go onto Adventures Unlimited, they're all available there as well.
Excellent. Okay, so fascinating stuff. Looking forward to continuing with you now in the subscriber section. But for this section, thank you very much, and we will take a short break and be right back. We are going to continue our discussion with Ralph Ellis in the subscriber section, and we've split this one up into two parts since the conversation was so lengthy. In this first part, we'll talk about King Solomon as a pharaoh of Egypt, Hiram Abiff, the Masonic deity, and also about the city Tanis in Egypt, very interesting material. And we'll continue next week talking about the Stone of Destiny, Cleopatra, Jesus as a pharaoh and grandson to Cleopatra, Scota, and also the connection with Scotland. So I hope you join us in the subscriber section for this first part now with Ralph Ellis. If you're currently not subscribing and are interested in doing so, click on subscribe from our front page, redicecreations.com, and read more about it. You'll get full access to our archive going back to when we started up. Subscribing is the best way to help and support this radio show. Also, you do not need a PayPal account or credit card to sign up. Check out our alternative payment methods under our subscribe link for much more information on that. Try it out for 6 months, it's about 12 US cents a day, and help us out. Also, make sure to stop by our forum and say hello, share a few words with some of the other visitors and listeners of Red Ice Creations Radio. Okay, so thank you so much for tuning in and following along this radio show. Also, my thanks to Fredrik Palmgren for handling the audio. We will be back on Thursday with Mike Hagen from Radio Orbit, so heads up on that. This is Henrik Palmgren, wishing you all happy Ishtar. Take care, guys and gals. We'll talk more soon.